Today, we speak to Preet Bharara, a former US attorney who has taken on mafia bosses and Wall Street executives, but who was later sat by Donald Trump and now does podcasting like us. And the changing sounds of the oceans and what it tells us about the environment. You're Indian, aren't you?
I am.
So I'm Indian, and I'm assuming
nice to meet you.
You too. But your parents...
I immediately felt a bond.
That's it. We're in this now. So your parents, like mine, wanted you to become a doctor.
And they did, and look how much we disappointed them.
I mean, we're both podcasters. Where did it all go wrong?
How far we've fallen.
I'm joking about the podcasting. You actually did the good Asian thing. You became a lawyer. Did you always know you wanted to do that?
I did. You know, I didn't want to become any kind of lawyer. I aspired to be a public interest lawyer, public service lawyer, and ended up becoming a prosecutor. Once I went to law school and started learning even more about what that kind of job is in the U.S.
Preet Bharara rose to become one of the best-known lawyers of his generation. Nicknamed the Sheriff of Wall Street after becoming the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, he also took on Russian oligarchs, mafia bosses, terrorists, and became the inspiration for the prosecutor in the hit television series Billions.
What we do has consequences, intended and unintended. The decisions we make, the actions we bring, have weight.
Bharara was appointed by Barack Obama and initially told he would be kept on by Donald Trump. But that did not last long.
Finally, I got the call.
You got sacked.
I got
in
sacked.
The end.
I got sacked, and I think that in some ways is a badge of honor.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, getting sacked by Donald Trump.
I was sworn in on August 13th of 2009.
After Preet Bharara was appointed U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, he went on to prosecute nearly 100 Wall Street executives for insider trading and other offenses.
All of the charged SAC companies have agreed to plead guilty.
But the job was not just about financial crime.
We don't do, you know, really rape cases, stabbing cases, street crime cases. We have the benefit of being able to work with the FBI and other federal agencies to bring massive scale cases. So we bring international terrorism cases, international narcotics cases, cybercrime, corporate fraud.
Over the years, Bharara took on wealthy and powerful interests from across the world, becoming a thorn in Russia's side.
We had this whole case with Russian spies in my first year in office, where 10 people were from Russia who were living, pretending to be Americans for a number of years, trying to gather intelligence on the American political system and other things.
In the end, he was blacklisted from Moscow. He took on some of the most notorious terrorists in the world.
The son-in-law of Osama bin Laden has been sentenced to life in prison following a conviction for conspiring to kill Americans. Suleiman Abu Ghraith is the most senior al-Qaeda member to be tried in a U.S.
But he leaves office frustrated that he was not able to prosecute the mastermind of 9/11. That is despite a phone call in the first few months in the job suggesting that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and co-defendants could be moved to New York to be tried. Instead, they still remain in Guantanamo Bay.
If we had been given the opportunity, they would have been convicted in a way that would have shown the world the power of a democratic, open justice system. I think they would not have been given a platform from which to spew more hatred. I think there would have been a controlled environment in the courtroom in the Southern District of New York. And I think victims would have gotten some closure.
So your job has meant taking on Wall Street executives and terrorists, but clearly gang violence and organized crime is also a feature of New York. I mean, in one instance, you oversaw the charging of 120 alleged street gang members in the Bronx, which was described as the largest gang takedown in New York history. And films about the mafia are based in New York. How much of a problem is that type of organized crime in the city now?
It's better than it was. They're still alive and kicking. They still use baseball bats. There's still extortion. But they're a bit less violent than in the 80s and the 90s. And that's because I think a lot of people did a lot of good law enforcement. When I first showed up, you know, 10 years ago, I think there was a dedicated FBI squad for every traditional Italian organized crime family in New York, Lucchese's, Bonanno's, Gambino's, etc. Now there are fewer FBI squads. A lot of those resources have been transferred to cyber.
Do you get paid a lot less than if you went into corporate law?
Yeah, a lot less.
Well, how much do you get paid?
The United States attorney, according to statute, I believe, when I was there, was paid $160,000 a year.
Sounds pretty good.
In America, if you have that kind of background, you probably are able to make between $4 and $8 million a year after that job.
Wow. What's it like? I mean, part of your job would have been to stand up in front of maybe an alleged gang member or an alleged terrorist with their family maybe sitting behind you watching what's going on. It must have been terrifying.
No, I mean, if you're terrified by that, then you shouldn't be in the job. In the same way that if you're a physician and blood makes you squeamish,
well, it's a bit worse
you
than
shouldn't,
that.
You should. I don't know if it's worse than that. I mean, you do your job.
I mean, you're trying to bring down some of the most criminal, scary individuals in the world.
Yeah, but most of them, it's not personal. This would never make my wife satisfied when I would state the following statistic, but there's really only one known case in recent times of a federal prosecutor being killed by someone who was investigating them. So, you know, the statistics are pretty good.
So I'm interested that you have that conversation with your wife. So she was quite worried.
Oh, she was quite worried. But, you know, everyone takes, look, you take precautions. We took a lot of precautions. You know, I have three kids who have not been allowed to have an online presence.
Zero.
I mean, now maybe a little bit because I've been out of office for 2 years. In fact, until this book, I've never mentioned their names publicly, ever. And, you know, just provide some measure of anonymity. I've never let them be photographed for anything relating to, you know, to that would be published anywhere. So you take precautions like that. You have a security system. You use an alias. I use an alias a lot. A little bit better now because, you know, podcasters are not so much targets of the mafia.
And just before we move on from this, I'm just really interested in how you manage such a high-powered job with three children. I mean, how did you balance that out?
You know, somebody once said it's very difficult to have balance if you're trying to be, you know, inordinately successful. And in my case, my wife, you know, took on a lot of that burden. And so I was absent a lot. I was away a lot. I worked late a lot and worked a lot of weekends and missed some things. So, you know, it's difficult. And what I always say about my job is that hopefully my kids understood and understand that, you know, their dad was away a lot and was busy and focused on his work because it was important work. And he was trying to make, you know, the community and the country a little bit safer and a little bit better. And so maybe that provides a little bit more of an excuse to my not being around as much as maybe I would have wanted to be. And I would have remained in public service, but for being fired by Donald Trump. And I was so committed to it that I agreed in odd circumstances to continue on, even though I didn't agree with the policies of Donald Trump. He was not my candidate for president. And so at a minimum, I think for, you know, anybody listening, that government service is much denigrated now, especially by people in my country. And I think that's unfortunate. And I think people need to, you know, think about what they have. You know, my family is an immigrant family. We started the interview talking about being Indian. What that has meant for me in America is that, you know, we feel very, very grateful. And there's a lot of terrible talk about immigrants and the denigration of people who come from certain countries and not from other countries. But, you know, by and large, our experience has been that we have had opportunity and you know, chances at advancement that we wouldn't have had anywhere else. I mean, the idea that I was born Pritinder Singh Brara in Punjab, India, emigrated to the United States, grew up in New Jersey, and I became, you know, the first Indian American chief law enforcement officer of Manhattan, appointed by the first African American president in the history of the country. It's a very inspiring thing. You know, even if I messed it up, it's still pretty inspiring that I got to do that.
Oh, you think you messed it up? We'll come to that.
Well, I hope not. I'm trying to be humble here.
So you've presented this kind of inspiring moment where you felt that you, as an immigrant to the United States, made it to this very senior position. The president was the first African-American president that the country had ever known. And along comes Donald Trump. What did you think when you started to see his candidacy? I mean, did you believe that he would be president?
I didn't. I'm not as smart of a prognosticator as some people. But I, like a lot of people in America, didn't take it seriously. You know, Donald Trump was right about some things. I don't agree with how he's executed on his promises. In my first speech that I gave after I left office, I said Donald Trump was right that the system is rigged in a lot of ways. Donald Trump is right that there's a swamp that needs to be drained. And Donald Trump was right that a lot of people have been forgotten. I think all of those things are true. And for people who, like me, didn't see that not only all those things were true, that weren't thinking about them, weren't envisioning what happens when someone speaks to people who have felt disenfranchised in that way, all across the country, you know, to the tune of tens of millions of people, then we've missed something.
What is the swamp? Were you in the swamp?
I don't think so. I think I was responsible for, you know, at least trying to drain the swamp. I mean, I think people have a view, and it's not totally incorrect, that both in the corporate world and in the political world, there is, you know, people are knee-deep in corruption. One of the things I'm proudest of as U.S. attorney, we brought more public corruption cases against sitting elected members of the state legislature and the city council than I think anyone ever had before. And there had always been this suspicion that there were politicians there who didn't have the interest of the citizens at heart, that they were trying to line their own pockets, and they were trying to profit from being in elective office, which is not how it's supposed to work. And, you know, that's very swampy.
But isn't that, it's quite an easy attack of, say, for example, the political classes in the UK or in the US.
Yeah,
but
an easy attack in part because it's in part true.
Well, the flip argument of that would be that a lot of those people you're talking about are also people offering public service, earning a lot less than they could earn in other jobs.
Completely correct. And I made certain to say that the majority of people who do those things are public servants and shouldn't be denigrated. But there was a period of time, and I don't know if this is still true because I haven't checked because I'm busy podcasting, but it used to be true for a period of time that if you were a sitting New York State senator, you know, elected to office, that you had a greater likelihood of leaving office because of indictment for a crime than being defeated at the polls. And so I tried to make sure when I inveighed against that I was talking about the bad apples, but there happened to be a lot of bad apples. And I think also people who are elected to office and people who are in public service generally and in high office should be held to a higher standard.
You obviously agreed with some of what Donald Trump said. Some of the things he was saying were pretty scary. They were pretty
Absolutely.
Unpleasant about immigrants.
Absolutely.
Leading chants of lock her up about Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, and saying, making a proclamation, I want to ban all Muslims.
Was that scary to watch?
Yeah, it was scary. It was unsettling. I think also it was less scary to some people in the campaign because people didn't think he was going to win. And I think there was like a naive view on the part of a lot of people, including myself, that was campaign talk. And no real legit president who wants to be the president for everyone, not just his base, is going to really follow through on those things. And then on day 8 of the presidency, he said, we're going to ban all Muslims, essentially.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
And he was, you know, fought on that in the courts and lost again and again and again until he watered it down and made it much more narrow. But I think that people were A, caught off guard by the rise of his candidacy, and B, had hope against hope, maybe this was overly optimistic, that he was not going to carry through on some of the more odious promises that he had made, including the wall.
So you've presented this kind of inspiring moment where you felt that you as an immigrant to the United States made it to this very senior position. The president was the first African-American president that the country had ever known. And along comes Donald Trump. Just out of interest, before we knew he was running for president, I mean, you were based in New York. Was he someone who was on your radar at all?
Yeah, so everyone wants to ask some version of that question. And I don't talk about who was or was not on the radar. Unless, you know, we spoke through cases that were actually brought, and if there was an indictment brought, then that means something. So I think it would be inappropriate for me to say if he was or wasn't.
I mean, pretty early on in November 2016, you met him.
I did.
At Trump Tower. Can you take us into that meeting?
Yeah, so I expected that I would be done with my public service because a president of the opposing party had been appointed, and that person is entitled to his own, not just cabinet officials, but everyone else. And that's the standard operating procedure. And I figured I had a few months left and there would be orderly transition to my successor, who would be appointed by Donald Trump. And instead, he contacted Chuck Schumer, for whom I worked, and indicated to him that he thought, based on what he knew about me in the office, that I should stay, invited me into Trump Tower, the famous Trump Tower that everyone now is familiar with, on the 26th floor.
Did you go in the gold lift?
I got in the gold lift, and there's a velvet rope that cordoned off all these reporters, and they would see who was coming and who was going. And at the time, obviously, I was the sitting United States attorney. And while we're standing and waiting for the lift to come, press the up button, and there's this long minute or minute and a half until they're coming, and somebody from behind the press rope said, "Mr. Brar, are you here to serve a subpoena?" And there was laughter. I maintained a straight face. It was a perfectly pleasant meeting. Also in attendance were Steve Bannon and Jared Kushner, the president-elect's son-in-law. And we had a pleasant conversation about the work of my office. He was very complimentary about how we had done. He oddly asked me for my phone numbers, which is unusual given that someone must have had my phone numbers because that's how the meeting got arranged. And then later he called me a few times, but there was nothing unusual about it.
He called you a few times. What to say?
He called to shoot the breeze, which was unusual given...
Shoot the breeze about what?
How are you doing? What's going on? And I realized later, and in retrospect, having thought about it and reading a lot of things, including the Mueller report, I think, has the view that top members of law enforcement, including his attorney general, are not there to, be independent enforcers of the law, but are there, and this is laid out in black and white in the Mueller report, are there to protect him, if
he was
necessary.
Trying to make you into a friend.
I think so. I can't say that for sure. But what else explains the busiest man in the world who has no relationship to a person who's a couple levels down from the attorney general calling him up to chat him up?
Did you save his number?
No, I did not take his. It was a one-way attempted relationship. And then after he became... So I didn't think there was anything I could do but return the calls when he was president-elect. Then he became president. And on March 9th of 2017, some weeks after he was inaugurated, he called to the secretary. A message was left because I was not at my desk and my assistant was away. And I thought about whether I should return the call. And this may seem unusual to a lot of people that the president of the United States of America, who is responsible for you maintaining your position, calls you and you deign not to call him back.
Well, I think it's very rude, isn't it?
I guess depending on your perspective. And I know that it seems odd, but you know what? He shouldn't have been calling me. I thought nothing good can come of that phone call. And so I didn't return the call, made it clear that I didn't think it was appropriate. But if I knew what it was about and we had other people, including the attorney general, involved, which would be the normal protocol, we could have that conversation some other time. And 22 hours later, I was asked to resign.
Despite Trump giving you the impression that he was going to allow you to keep the job, for whatever reason, he changed his mind and you were sacked pretty much right at the beginning of his presidency. And his presidency has been pretty much dominated by Robert Mueller's investigation into interference in the 2016 presidential election, which, as we know, was finally submitted to Attorney General William Barr this spring. We first found out about the conclusions of the report through Barr's four-page summary. What did you think about that when you first read it?
So, I didn't know what to think when I read the four-page summary, which he kept saying was not a summary, but of course it was a summary. It seemed a little facile. It seemed a little bit like it was public relations. The other thing I will say that I didn't like was that Bill Barr decided to sort of take the open question of whether or not obstruction had been committed by the president and answer that question, even though it was my speculation that Bob Mueller had not intended for Bill Barr to answer it. And now, having read the report, I think it's very clear that Bob Mueller did not intend for Bill Barr to make a proclamation, basically, of exoneration, because Bob Mueller went out of his way to say on the issue of obstruction, the president was not exonerated.
And when you read the entire report, or the redacted report?
It's a devastating account of, a lot of misfunction and dysfunction in the White House. A lot of attempts by, at a minimum, by the president to obstruct justice. I mean, there's an important line in the report that says, one of the reasons why actual obstruction in some regards was not accomplished was that every step of the way, people who were handpicked by Donald Trump himself refused his orders, decided not to do the things that he said, including have Bob Mueller fired, including restrict the purview of the investigation and make it about, future election interference and not about what had happened in the past. And time and time again, I think you can say that it's fair to conclude that those people saved Donald Trump's presidency, even though he doesn't like them, even though he doesn't feel any gratitude towards them. And I think it's a very, very, very negative portrait of what has been going on in the White House. Whether or not there'll be a future charge, I don't know. It might sound peculiar to folks in the UK, and it sounds very peculiar to a lot of folks in the US, that there is an interpretation of the Constitution by the Justice Department itself from some years ago that states fairly unequivocally that you cannot indict or prosecute a sitting president. So in some ways, it makes this issue of whether or not he can be brought up on charges moot. And Bob Mueller accepted that legal conclusion. And so what he did instead was lay out, I think, a very strong case for obstruction, though he did not say that outright.
And yet your own former office is pursuing multiple investigations into Donald Trump.
They are. And that, that's separate from what the special counsel did. As people may know, my old office is overseeing the prosecution of Michael Cohen, who is the personal lawyer, former personal lawyer to the president. He has pled guilty. Michael Cohen has pled guilty to campaign finance violations, is prepared to go to prison for them. I think he's on the cusp of going to prison, and has also implicated Donald Trump in that criminal activity. So that, I think, is another area of exposure for the president in the future.
Although he would say that he's been vindicated, how bad do you think the Mueller report is for Donald Trump?
I think it's pretty bad for him. But on the ultimate question of whether or not he's going to be charged, it's obviously good for him. Look, Donald Trump says that things exonerate him when they have nothing. Donald Trump will walk into a Chinese restaurant, pick up the menu, and says the menu exonerates him. That doesn't make it so.
Preet, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Preet Bharara, whose book, Doing Justice, A Prosecutor's Thoughts on Crime, Punishment and the Rule of Law, is out now. Coming up, we hear about diving the Great Barrier Reef. Welcome back. Last month, the scientific journal Nature published results that showed the number of new corals on the Great Barrier Reef in 2018 crashed by 89% after 2 years of mass bleaching. That is when, as sea temperature rises, coral drive out the algae that gives them their colour, leaving them stripped of their vibrancy. Recovery is possible, but it might take a decade or more, and more bleaching could cause the coral to die. Tim Gordon is a marine biologist at the University of Exeter. When he finally realised his childhood dream of diving the Great Barrier Reef, he encountered a grey and deathly quiet world.
I grew up, brought up on a diet of David Attenborough documentaries and, you know, nature posters up on the wall and things. And I had in mind that the Great Barrier Reef was this kaleidoscope of colour and this symphony of sound and this complete bustle of life, you know, underwater city of the sea type thing. And I was all set to go there and do a research project on the bioacoustics of this wonderfully diverse, incredible ecosystem. It's a long journey. Going to the Barrier Reef takes a while. We'd get all our equipment together, dive medical gear checked, and then we get on a little six-seater aeroplane out to a place called Lizard Island, which is way out in the remote northern reaches of the Barrier Reef. You can see the reef as you fly over. The coral formations appear dark compared to the white of the light sand below, and occasionally you can see sharks and big fish going between the corals as you fly over. Touch down on this tiny lump of rock in the middle of the sea. It's a really exciting experience. And then, of course, you can get off the plane and rummage around your bag for your snorkel, and the first thing you do is jump in the sea and go and have a look. The sun was just starting to set as we were swimming around, and what I was met with was not what I was used to seeing on TV and what I had posters up on my bedroom wall growing up, but was this dying rubble field. It was really heartbreaking. The place that you have been so inspired by and the place that you have been so looking forward to understanding more of and marvelling at and studying in more depth has changed beyond all recognition. On a healthy reef, the sound is really overwhelming. First thing that hits you is this sort of crackle of shrimp noise that's all over the place. It's kind of like frying bacon, you know, that's going on everywhere. And then that's punctuated by the sounds of fish and they range from sort of low frequency popping or grunting sounds. Sometimes there's a slightly higher pitch sort of whooping and chirping sounds. There's like quite percussive chatters some of the time. And then occasionally there's noises you just don't know what they are. And you hear them and you think, goodness me, what on earth was that? And nobody knows some of the time. That's the beauty of it. Bleached reefs sound very different. They sound eerie, is probably the best way of putting it, because you dive down below the waves, you are still, you hold your breath, you clear your ears, and where you would expect to hear all that noise going on around you, you just hear emptiness. There's still some aspects of it there. You hear a bit of a crackle. It's much quieter. You probably don't hear nearly as many fish. You don't hear nearly as much sort of diversity of sound and activity. And sometimes you notice the things that you can't usually hear, the sounds of things on the shore that would usually be drowned out by all of this life around you, but in the emptiness they now come through. And that's, for me, quite a haunting reminder of what's no longer there. I went to the Barrier Reef knowing that it was the biggest living organism on the planet, and it's this astonishing example of an incredibly diverse system, but it had been through this massive degradation in the last year before I'd got there. And this was a place that had been really severely damaged. For me, yes, it's heartbreaking to hear that the sound of the reef has changed, but it's actually a really important functional role in the ecosystem as well. So as well as being heartbreaking as a symptom, it's terrifying as a prediction of what is going to happen next. Because many, many organisms, fish, invertebrates, even corals, have a larval planktonic stage. That means at the start of their life, the larvae of the animals are swept out into the open ocean. And then they grow up in the open ocean, and then they come back as adults to the reef to start their adult life. That journey back to the reef, they do that using sound amongst other mechanisms, but a large part of the way that they find their way home is that they can hear reefs, because sound travels really well. They hear the reef sound from a distance away, and then they're able to use that as a cue to navigate towards reefs, and also as a cue to settle on reefs, so also as a sort of decision-making prompt. I can hear that I'm on a healthy reef, now I'm going to settle. So we've done a range of experiments on a range of different animals that show that when they hear this sound, they navigate towards it, and they use that sound as a cue to start their life on the reef. If the reef sound changes, then that behavioural mechanism may well break down, and we're starting to see evidence that that will be the case, and that these animals that used to come and feed the next generation of the reef, grow up to be the next animals on the reef that are so central to its functioning, graze away the algae, that form associations with each other, create the whole fabric of the community. If they're not being replaced by this larval replenishment each year, then the populations are going to crash. And if there's no healthy sound to draw them in, I would really worry that the future of the reef is jeopardized by its silence today.
That was Tim Gordon. His story is part of The Guardian's podcast series called Oceans of Noise, looking at the sounds of the seas and the threat of noise pollution. You can listen to the whole series in The Guardian Science Weekly podcast feed right now. That's all for today. My thanks to Preet Bharara and to Tim Gordon. Today's episode was produced by Rachel Humphreys, Josh Kelly, Chika Ayres and David Waters. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.